The name of my talk is Stepping Pones, Adventures in Full Spectrum Embedded Exploitation. And here's a really important thing, defense, which is the thing that I've been working on as part of my PhD program for the last 5 years. And the slides are here at www.rebelloonsecurity.com/slides.pdf. It's 100 megs because unicorns cannot, they're magical and they cannot be compressed. Sorry. And this is what our demo setup looked like that we brought to on stage. You're looking at a lot of routers, a lot of printers, a lot of phones. I'll hopefully be able to talk through what actually happened live on stage, but you know, I swear, like these things actually worked in real time, like live on stage. So I've been giving some offensive talks on embedded devices, and this is how our typical talk always goes. You know, first we find a new shiny thing to look at, you know, be it a car or a pacemaker or a printer or a phone, and we say, hey, look at this thing. We should probably figure out if this is secure or not. And then we spend months in Fail Shack trying to figure out how to exploit these things and failing, so we have to put a lot of the ways we figure out how not to hack these things into our slides. And then we get excited because we find that one vulnerability, that one exploit that works, that makes us happy. But then here's the bad news, the impact. It turns out usually these things are all over the place, they run our lives, you know, our infrastructure depends on it, and there's no way we can really get away from the impact of the security vulnerability. So this is the bad news. But then we feel bad about saying that, so we say, okay, don't worry, there's a duct tape fix, right? So you could disable the console port of the phone, or you could take this thing off the network, or if this thing never printed PDFs, you know, you're okay, right? And this is me, so I usually put in pictures of cats and things I find on Google image search. The last 5 minutes of the talk, I always sneak in something that says, wouldn't it be nice if we had a real solution to this problem? Not, you know, reinvention of the entire architecture, but an actual practical solution that will go out and defend embedded devices that exist in the world today. Right, a few slides, and they say goodbye, you know, see you next time, and we start this process all over again. So we worked really hard this summer to make this talk a different one. We're gonna spend half the time talking about offensive capabilities that we've developed. And by that, I mean real embedded polymorphic or polyspecies malware propagation. So propagation of malware from something like a printer to a phone to a router and vice versa in full mesh configuration. And then I want to spend half of this talk talking about the defensive work that we've worked at Columbia, and now we're transitioning into a company called Rebelloon Security that I've been working on for the last 5 years. And instead of cats, we're going to do unicorns today, because that's what I found on image search. So here's the cast of human characters. Sal Stoffel is my PhD advisor and co-founder of Rebelloon Security. Michael Costello is camera shy, but there's another Michael Costello on Project Runway, and he's very fantastic looking. Jaden Kateria is our research scientist at RBS, and here's me. I'm a PhD student at Columbia, and I founded this company. And we have a special guest appearance by this guy named Mikey Droptables, who is the mayor of Pwnctown, which we'll talk about briefly. Pwnctown, okay, is located halfway between Carthage and New Jersey, and Mikey Droptable is definitely the mayor. So that's not all. The equipment that we brought on stage for DEF CON is here. This is the cast of machines. And I think this is stuff that we've all been familiar with. You may not see it every single day. Like this 2821 router is something that you probably find in most of your networking closets. And here's the HP LaserJet 2055 printer, which we see all over the place. The Cisco phone, the Cisco 7961 phone, is something that I worked on a few months ago. And here's a new one. This is the brand new spanking new Cisco 89,000 and 99,000 phone, which we released a 0 day for at Black Hat. And it's actually kind of cool. This is, Cisco tells me that this is a completely randomized string for their bug report, but that's my last name, CS Tui. So that's pretty neat. I don't know if that was an accident. And then we also threw in an 1841 router because these things are small and good for demos. And I'm gonna talk a little bit about our work on Avaya phones, just to get the idea that, you know, Cisco is not the only IP phone maker out there that has problems. Basically every other vendor we've looked at has not exactly the same problems, but also very serious ones. So this is what I'm looking at. This is the very typical view of the network. You have on top the big bad internet, right? Then you have your intranet, where you know this thing's protected by a firewall, router, whatever it is. And of course, Pwnctown lives on the right side of internet, where Mikey Droptable is mayor. Now, to Mikey, right, your intranet is a mystery because the firewall prevents a lot of this stuff from coming in. Recon into this closed off fortified space is not easy, but he knows that somewhere in your organization there's a printer, right? Doesn't matter where you are, be it university or a bunker under the ground or a nuclear submarine, there's probably a printer somewhere. And this is what he does. He makes up a really nice resume, right? Something that will, you know, impress some person in this organization, and they'll be compelled to print it out, right? And once that resume is printed out, we worked on a vulnerability on all of the HP LaserJet printers that's been made in the last decade that would allow the attacker to arbitrarily modify the firmware of that device once the page comes out. And the page still comes out too, so that's nice. So once he's in, right, he has absolute control over the hardware and software of this printer. And now that the question is, you know, what can you really do with that, right? Well, it'd be nice if you, okay, so why am I talking about this thing? This is an 18-month-old vulnerability now. And if I was up here talking about 18-month-old vulnerability for Firefox, right, this wouldn't be interesting at all. But it turns out in the embedded world, 14 months after the patch was released, a few months after we worked with a vendor and they released the patch for every single LaserJet printer in production, we scanned IPv4 looking for vulnerable printers that have been unpatched, and we found that 4.7% of them have been patched. Right? So 93% of all the printers on the internet are still vulnerable to an 18-month-old embedded vulnerability. And what this number tells me is that people don't patch the printers. The increase in the patch rate is basically from printers that are being bought by customers as old ones are retired, because they shoot for about a 5-year lifespan for these things. Which means half the printers that are shipped with the old firmware, right, if you do this number out. Because you should be expecting double-digit patch rate, you know, a year and a half later. But anyway, so this is still relevant, right? This vulnerability is still in most of the networks I've encountered. And this is what happens. You know, once Mikey Droptables gets access to the printer, what he will do is make a reverse IP tunnel out of the firewall back to the Pwntown where he is listening. And then he's going to send down command and control packets to instruct this printer to do interesting things. All right, this is what he'll do. He'll first use the printer to do reconnaissance on the network to figure out what other embedded devices there are for him to compromise. And while he's doing it, he's really being under the radar of your general purpose intrusion detection systems, host-based intrusion detection systems on your servers and your desktops. And if everything works out right, he can then use this as the leverage point to then drop all sorts of malicious payloads right onto these embedded devices. So we looked at printers. We found serious vulnerabilities in the HP LaserJet printer line. You can read about our paper down here. And then we looked at routers. We did some offensive malicious implant for Cisco iOS. And we also looked at phones, a number of phones, old Cisco 7961s and the new 9000, 8000 series phones. And we found vulnerabilities that would lead to absolute control of the device in every single one of these. So looking at each individual device is fairly easy, and I have to put this in air quotes, because you can break it apart, look at the code, look at the hardware, and eventually you're going to figure out some way to make it do the thing you want it to do. And this is something I made for my candidacy exam. You know, I was convinced that in the future, in the near future, you're going to see poly-species malware propagation in the embedded device space. Because if you can break into, you know, three different types of embedded device, the obvious next step would be to make it all work together in a cohesive unit. Well, it turns out that's actually not really all that simple. There are certainly challenges. There are three specific challenges which I'll talk about, and we solved. But here's the idea, that once you get into the router, right, you go and you find drop malicious implants on the phones and the printers and whatnot. And from that point on, you essentially own maybe not the actual laptop or the server on that network, but you own everything else. You own essentially the substrate of the entire network, period. And that's very interesting to me. But why is this difficult? Well, let's look at, you know, this cast of machines. You're talking about devices that are manufactured by different vendors in different times, right? Cisco, Avaya, HP, with all sorts of different unknown code base. You're still looking at different CPU architectures, MIPS, ARM, PowerPC sometimes, maybe even x86, even AVR. And then you're looking at operating systems that you may or may not have an understanding of. So Linux, we sort of know how that works, but you know, what does this thing run? Mystery. What is CNU? It sounds like Unix, but it really isn't. Cisco iOS, you know, it's been around, so we have some understanding, but all of this is proprietary. So, you know, do you know that Cisco iOS has a kernel? It doesn't, right? Not really, not in the traditional sense. Now, I want to take a step back and say the defensive demos and the offensive demos are using the same insight that we found over the last 5 years of work. Because when you solve the offensive problem, you're really solving the defensive problem. So in fact, we're taking the insights we got from the defensive work to make this offensive demo happen. And here are the three main challenges that you really need to solve if you want to do embedded polyspecies malware propagation practically. The very first one is, how do you get your foot in the door? How do I make modifications to the firmware that runs on every single one of these devices? If I can't do it, I can't change the way this thing behaves. And it turns out there are a number of ways of doing it. We wrote a system called FRAC, which we published at Black Hat. We gave a talk at Black Hat. We're continuing to build on this thing. But for us, internally at least, FRAC has basically solved the generalized firmware modification process. We can unpack, analyze, modify, repack, resign all of these devices, and it more or less is a framework that is pretty stable now. So once you have that solved, the next thing is, what do you want to execute, right? By execute, I don't mean just single CPU instructions, right? I mean semantically equivalent code inside unknown operating systems on a diverse set of hardware platforms that will, let's say, give me essentially the same command and control capability across all of these devices without really understanding how those devices work. Now, once you solve that problem, there's an actual even trickier problem, which is the input and output problem. So if I can execute the same payload, right, on a printer and a phone, how do I get data in and out of this device, right? Because to do I/O, you generally need to know exactly or precisely how the network subsystem works. For example, how does Indus work? How does network packets bubble up the stack inside Linux? And sometimes you can dig up that documentation, but a lot of times this is mystery. So can we do this in a way that's generalized, that doesn't require us to know exactly how the network infrastructure works in that particular device? So let's talk about the generalized execution problem and solution. So forget about everything you know about every operating system, right? This is a black box that computes. Somewhere in that black box is code and memory, or code and data. Somewhere in the data section, you see something that we generally refer to as IOMEM. Inside the code section, we have code that generally isn't required for the operation of that device. So if you buy, let's say, a Linksys router, it's gonna come with you know, every networking protocol under the sun. It's gonna come up debugging messages, syslog infrastructure, and things that really isn't necessary for that thing to work in that particular environment. On the other hand, it has positions in code that we know will execute with high frequency, with high confidence. Which we can use as intercept points. And a good example of that is, let's say on MIPS, the ERET instruction, right? Every time an exception fires off, you will be guaranteed that the ERET instruction will be called at the end of it. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff. If you can identify checksum functions, memcopy functions, printf, et cetera, you have a high confidence that those functions will be hit over and over again. And it turns out identifying these is really not all that difficult, practically speaking. So what we do is we take away some dead code and we replace it with the payload that we want to execute. And this payload will essentially turn itself into a binary scheduler. It schedules itself and whatever other code the host program is executing. So, you know, once in a while, it will context switch in. It will then execute a small piece of its own payload and then context switch out to allow the host program to continue executing without affecting its functionality. And then you take some other space and you replace this with stack space and other dynamic memory regions, scratch area, et cetera. And then last step, you hook every single one of these easily identifiable intercept points, right, to the payload so that as the device is executing, right, we get more or less high confidence that our payload will continue to execute. Now, once you have that, you get perpetual control of the CPU, and you actually even escape constraints of things like watchdog dimmer inside Cisco iOS, because this will be divided across multiple processes, and you're no longer constrained by, you know, watchdog timer and system resource utilization. Okay, so that's how we solve the generalized execution problem. That's also the way the software symbiote defense works, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Once you have that, let's talk about the generalized input-output problem. I'm gonna solve the input problem, at least using the solution to the execution problem. And here's how we did it. Instead of, you know, the payload, we have what's called a packet scrubber, right? This is basically Easter hunt, egg hunt. We look through IO memory, right? We do the same hooking as we did before, so that as the host space, as the host program executes, the packet scrubber gets to execute. And what it does is it does essentially a linear scan through IO memory range, whatever memory range you want, looking for predefined patterns that we'll call command and control patterns. Okay, so as the device is executing, let's say we send packets to it through the network, or we display a JPEG that contains a pattern that corresponds to command and control, the packet scrubber will identify that package, parse it, and then execute the corresponding module for the command and control. You can do anything you want. We're going to show you memory exfiltration, memory modification, code execution, and some other fun things. Right. So as the device is running, you know, we're picking out command and control from IOMEM. Note that it doesn't matter how the command and control pattern gets inside IOMEM. Right. This could be through a UDP packet. This could be through an ICMP echo request. Right. This could be through something that's TTL expired. As soon as that packet is copied into IOMEM through any way whatsoever, we'll be able to identify this in fairly quick order. Okay, so take a step back and think. Is this something that's ARM specific? No, this will work for MIPS, AVRX86, PowerPC, right? This is not ISA dependent. Now, is this something that will only work in VxWorks? It won't. It'll work inside LinuxOS or Windows CE, iOS, little iOS, big iOS, the Linux kernel inside a small DSP program. So this is really a generalized way of getting at least input to a device without understanding how the internal environment works at all. For completeness, this is our command and control structure. We have here a predefined pattern. ACAC is my initial, so I made it that, followed by some metadata that allows us to make sure that the integrity of this thing hasn't been valid or corrupted with a little checksum. And this is just the CNC envelope. Okay, and then once we validate the envelope, we can then put in commands and arguments and payloads, right? So this is a really easy way of doing command and control in mystery environment. So put it all together, you have your rootkit, right? And you have your packet scrubber. Traffic comes in and out, right? We pick out these CNC packets and we service them in turn. We have a sequence number so that, you know, we can load large amounts of code inside the memory of this device without, you know, we're having to worry about out of order seeks inside the command and control, packets being detected, et cetera. So that all works. And I'm sure you guys all heard, right? Barnaby Jack passed away very untimely. We've heard about this while I was making this presentation in our office, so we decided to do a tribute to him. I made the Barnaby function, which takes as input arbitrary embedded devices, and as output, puts his face into the working memory of these embedded devices. So we'll show you how that works in a little bit. And then I made a modify Barnaby function. And this one is the scary one. It does the same thing, but it does it permanently to affect real physical destruction of the device through software, right? So imagine if someone came along and quietly propagated this malware implant to your entire network substrate, going from the printers to the phones to the routers, right? And then at the same time, pull the kill switch. It would take you down, and coming back would be very difficult. By physical, I mean you literally have to desolder the flash from the device. Right, resolder another flash chip on before the device will work again. So demo time, I'm gonna talk roughly about how the demo worked and then I have screen dumps of what you would have seen if had I had all this stuff live on stage. So here we send a printer, right? So this is a firewall. Mikey Drop Tables is on the outside. He can't make incoming connections, but he somehow manages to get a PDF into this printer. He breaks into the printer, right? He sends a command and control packets to do a syn scan on the network to find other devices, right, that may be of interest. From there, he identifies the manufacturer of those devices, and from other fingerprinting methods, he'll figure out this is a phone, this is a router, this is a Cisco, this is an HP, et cetera. And from there, we actually showed vulnerabilities inside every single one of these devices that allows a network, or allows an attacker on the same segment of the network to gain root privilege on these devices. And this is also where we showed the new zero-day attack on the Cisco 8971 phone. Oh, one thing, I'm trying to give a shout out to this everywhere I can. The JTAGulator is a fantastic piece of hardware for people who work on hardware and waste a lot of time looking at JTAG pinouts. Joe Grand designed this thing. You should totally buy one or five. These things are great. And this board made our work with Avaya very possible. So that's great. I really love this hardware. Okay, so I'll show you the demo, but at the end of the day, population in Pwntown is 6, because this is definitely possible. Now, I found some fun facts, actually. So we're talking about denial of service, right? Distributed denial of service. I'm gonna show you a way to take the first D off of that and use something that is very tiny to destroy something that's very large. The little printer that could. It turns out this guy is a very capable piece of networking equipment. I can get this thing to send about 15,000 packets, right, without really any tricks at all. I mean, this thing just sends. So if you get it to yak at something, right, and those packets are cleverly constructed, you can probably have it take down something interesting from inside the organization. And we did that. So we did this game where we tried to DDoS, or denial of service, a Cisco 2821 router, which is responsive generally for core routing for a remote office. I mean, it's not the beefiest router, but you know, it's not bad, with a single $150 LaserJet printer, right? And it turns out this thing wins all day, and I was able to peg the CPU utilization of the 2821 to 99%, you know, without any trouble, right, with a single printer. So imagine what you can do with two printers inside your organization. And the way we did this was by sending very large malformed TCP packets to the OSPF address, the OSPF hello address of the router. So this doesn't just kill this one router, it kills everything in the same OSPF domain, which is nice. So that's the offensive demo, which I'll walk you through later if I have time. But the thing that I've been working on for the last 5 years is ways to defend this type of attack, right? We don't have any host-based defense on legacy embedded systems. We don't have anything that's practical. So this is what we did for this demonstration. We have what's called the software symbiote technology, which is essentially host-based defense that is injected into an unknown operating system, unknown embedded device, through a bunch of things that we've published inside a number of papers, that allows us to execute arbitrary code in a reliable way without affecting the functionality of the embedded device. And what we do with that payload is we actually implemented a dynamic firmware attestation algorithm that just continuously verifies that the static regions of code inside these embedded devices stay static as they're running. So not, you know, timing-based attestation, we're not talking about static attestation, we're talking about continuous verification of code staying static when they should stay static. And we have this thing now working on ARM MIPS, Cisco 7961 phones, Cisco routers, and also the HP printer. So with this symbiote technology enabled, there's a single population in Pongtown is now one, which is a sad unicorn there. And here, this is our experimental setup. And I want to show you the defense demo. I don't know if you guys can read that. Can you see that at all? Or is it not too easy? But, well, we developed this console, right? So this console is being run outside of the corporate firewall. This is in Pongtown. And what we have here is that the printer calls back home, right? So as soon as the printer becomes compromised, you'll see an internal IP address being reported, right? So we know the outside IP address and the inside IP address of this printer. And we know nothing else about the internal network topology of intranet. And the first thing that we're going to do is send a command and control packet to the printer. Now, this is a command and control being sent through the reverse IP proxy, right, through the firewall to the printer itself. And then the printer services that command, and it does a SYN scan across the network, figuring out all of the other listening devices on, I think this is port 23, probably. And then now we have a bunch of IP addresses that are also live on the segment, right, something that we didn't know before. But we have no idea what these IP addresses do. We can scan ports and try to figure out what services they run. But the next thing we do, we implemented this function called download, right? Again, command that's sent through the reverse IP proxy to the printer. The printer does a bunch of stuff. And it basically exfiltrates the ARP cache table back to us so that we know the manufacturer of these pieces of hardware. And from that, we figured out, okay, so this guy here is a Cisco, right? Some Cisco phones. This is an HP printer, probably. We have other Cisco devices. Now, you know, we can do this for a while and figure out that this is probably, you know, phone 2 is probably, or Recon 2 is probably a telephone, a Cisco phone. And this is how we get from the printer to the phone, and this is kind of neat. The way that the Cisco phone works is every time there's an SSH connection going into it, the phone can't hold any per device provision file onto it, so it will make a request for the authorized keys file, right, to its predefined TFTP server. So it's like a door, right, asking the person who is putting in the key, like, which key would you like me to use to authenticate the key you're going to put in? And what we're doing here is we're using the printer to do ARP cache poisoning, right, to convince the phone that the printer is its own TFTP server, right? And this totally works, by the way. And then when the phone asks the printer, what should I use as my authorized keys file, we construct one in memory. It's an actual single UDP packet, very easy to send out, and very easy to deliver directly to the phone. And then the phone says, oh, okay, great, your key-based SSH authentication is a go, please log in, and we do. Okay, so here we have, we're inside the SSH prompt of this new 8971 phone. As you notice, this is no longer Cisco proprietary CNU. This is Monte Vista Linux. It claims to be 2.8, but that's a lie. Month of use that backpatches all the Linux kernel vulnerabilities back into 2.6. We spent a few days trying to do the all null pointer dereference stuff to get root on this thing, till we realized that every single thing that we know has been patched. And unless we go out and probably buy a zero day for 2.6, this is not a good way to go. So we started looking at just, instead of the open source community, instead of a company that specializes in securing the Linux kernel, let's just look at what the vendor did, right? What their responsibility was in this distribution. So we started looking around the dev directory, and we noticed this. I don't know if you guys can see it, but the dev MTD devices all have world writable permissions, right? So this is the underlying MTD for the file system, right? If I can write to this NAND flash, I could essentially put whatever file I want, completely bypassing all the security. And then we found that they shipped the bin flash, or the flash and the NAND erase and write and modify tools, along with the distribution of the phone, right? Probably because some engineer was playing with this thing and decided that this was a good thing to have on every single phone, right? And some of these things also have help message, so you can figure out how to use it. And then there's NAND dump and NAND write. So we didn't really have to do very much. This was kind of a cheap O-day, but it happened, right? After working on the old phone, exploiting this new phone actually was quite much easier than it was before. And at first I thought, well, that's not anything good to talk about, but it is, right? Things shouldn't be getting harder. I mean, things shouldn't be getting easier. This is much easier now in the future to exploit these things. So that's what happened. And then we put in, I wrote a little thing that basically a set UID, right, that I injected it into MTD device, which reflected itself into the file system. And from there, because I'm set UID, right, I get to be root, and you just run the thing, and it sets your effective UID to zero, and that's how you get root on this phone. Right, and from there, the DSP voice exfiltration stuff is exactly the same, so I can do the same thing I did with the old Cisco phone, right, and pull the mic data from the phone without affecting any LEDs and whatnot, and do all sorts of other stuff. And now we're on a Linux machine, so propagation from here out to all the other places, right? I mean, this is going to be a cakewalk. So I have 5 more minutes. From there, we did a whole bunch of reconnaissance. We actually have, then we installed the command and control implant into all of these devices. Now I wanted to show arbitrary memory read, write, execute on any one of these devices on Linux, Cisco iOS, mystery operating system inside the printer. And it totally works. And we did that by just doing the whole Barnaby function inside Cisco routers Cisco phones. So here is the command for when you do show version, right? Like a version string comes out for the printer. Instead, we wrote the piece of memory here and Barnaby's face comes up. And this works on all the routers and the phones and the printer as well. So that's that. And I want to show you the defense demo. This is software Symbio writing, and this is what I've been doing for the last 5 years. We have here Cisco phone, a 2821 router, 1841 router, and the HP printer. So we essentially went back and used the same vulnerabilities that we talked about in each one of these devices and made a modification inside the firmware of that device, giving us malicious implant capability. So the first thing we did, we ran the same pwn bin on the phone, right? And as soon as that happened, you notice that the internal checksum of the static memory region has changed, right? Detection latency here is about actually 80 milliseconds, so it's even faster than the router because this thing has a much faster CPU. And the next thing we did, right, we did something similar to the Cisco 2821, right? It goes from secure to pwned because the checksum value changes here as well. And we did this again on the 1841, same thing happened. We did, again, the same thing. We wrote a piece of memory to the printer. This is a picture of a Hello Kitty. In the configuration page. And the same thing happened, right? We detected all of these memory modification attacks in real time, and we're talking about from 80 to maybe 250 milliseconds of detection latency, right? On legacy embedded devices, without changing the functionality, you can route packets through the router, you can print to the printer, and you can make phone calls with the phone. So it all works. That exists now. And this is something that we're trying to transition into the commercial space through Red Balloon Security. And that's pretty much my talk. Thank you.
So a question about the defense. So what I absorbed the defense being is using the same hooking that your rootkit does.
Yep.
And you monitor regions of memory in your checksum to make sure they haven't been.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
what do you do when you see, yes, it's been done?
So this is what I always say. I give you a binary switch, right? I'm building a detector, and from that detection, we can talk about what the right appropriate response is. So for example, if this is a secret phone, and we have one that has a silent alarm, you probably don't want to patch that phone, right? Because then you give out a very important piece of information to your adversary that they know that you know. So the better way to do it then is to probably feed it false information. Now, if this is my mom's home router, I probably want her to reboot it, right, and reflash the firmware. And if this is the backbone router, you know, of let's say a financial exchange network, right, probably more investigation. But the detection and the actual action after detection is decoupled in this,
yeah.
And we can do a number of different things.
Okay, my name is Rick Farrow. Vern had my first question, so I can ask the second one.
Okay.
It sounded like the type of hooking that you're doing to in the code, finding unused places in the code, that would be called from time to time. Sounds a lot like something FX was doing to Cisco routers about 6 or 7 years ago.
Yes and no.
I have a faulty memory, but it sounds familiar.
Yeah, no, FX has definitely done a lot. I mean, he has the Recurity, you know, iOS Integrity Verifier. But like for that, he was pulling down memory dump at the time of crash to detect. So this is that work is certainly post-mortem. We're talking about real-time detection as the router is operating, right, without affecting the functionality of the router. And that's not something that's been done. Yeah.
Okay. No, but I meant the technique of hooking the code.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, hooking code is. I mean, that's a trick, right? I mean, that's a trick that's been around forever and ever. The trick really is to know where to hook and how to hook it. So on the offensive side, you can think about the offensive work as a symbiote that doesn't care about getting caught, right? Mm-hmm. That'll give you much better control of when the CPU will be hit. So if I just hook every single e-write instruction in MIPS, right? I have full confidence that instruction will be hit periodically because every time interrupt fires, I will get to run on the CPU. But as a defensive approach, that's a terrible approach because the adversary would then just go to all the e-writes and then unhook me. So on the symbiote side, what we do is we do a large number of very randomized injection points, right, instead of a small directed point injection point on the offensive side. So on Cisco iOS, we inject something like 45,000 places out of 175 potential injection sites for the defensive side. And for the offensive side, we probably just do 24.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Stefan Savage. Very nice talk. I'm trying to understand some of the limitations of the defense, so strengths and weaknesses are. And I didn't understand it perfectly, so I want to make sure that I run through it. It sounds like what you're doing, you're hooking a bunch of stuff, and then you're doing some kind of checksumming of static regions of memory. So what I'm curious about two kinds of things the adversary might do in response. So one is, it seems like you could try to live in dynamic memory where the invariant about whether this thing is good or bad is not clear to the monitor because it's dependent on the I/O that this device gets. Yep. So you can hang out in the heap. You can have the code that you use be return-oriented. There's lots of good return-oriented kits for iOS and so forth. Am I right in understanding that there's not a great way
for little iOS, right? Not for big iOS. Right?
Cisco iOS does a good return-oriented kit for Cisco iOS.
Cool.
In fact, there's a number of the exploits for iOS that are return-oriented just because there's so much variation between versions of iOS that doing return-oriented programming against the bootloader is a more portable way of
doing it. That.
But I'm right in understanding, I think, right, that the dependency here is that there is an invariant that you can test around the static portion, and if you are able to put your stuff in the dynamic range of memory, then life gets much harder.
It doesn't. So the symbiote work is definitely designed to detect persistent modification of code. We also have another part of the defense that I'm not talking about here. It's called ABSR, Autotomic Binary Structure Randomization, that's designed to make the dynamic exploitation much more difficult. But this essentially is a malicious implant detector.
Got it.
And if you have a way of popping in and out of memory to affect the system and then restore the original system, then you're playing a cat and mouse game, right? Which is something that all the timing-based attaches suffer from. But the nice thing about this one is that this is much more randomized, right? So you really have to be able to get lucky consistently if you want to survive the system for a long time. But ABSR is the thing that's designed to make ROP much more difficult against this type of attack. And I'll just give you like a little thing about how ABSR works. We actually take away the binary that's not necessary for the operation of that device. So in fact, we actually have a sample of Cisco IOS where we took out the BGP server and the HTTP server, and we have removed about 40% of the binary from the iOS image, and the router still works just fine. Uh-huh. Right? And once you can do that, you have a whole lot of freedom to play with dynamic defenses that you can build from that.
Cool. So the second part of the question was, so I really like the idea of going in and having a gazillion different injection points so that you can't undo it. I mean, this reminds me, you know, I will date myself, but in the early days of like MS-DOS, you had these terminate and stay resident programs Sidekick. They would hook everything under the sun so they couldn't be removed. What I'm curious about, though, in the embedded space, there is all of this like really grody code. It worked in the image they shipped, and like it knows that a microsecond after this happens, this other thing. Have you had any experience that you willy-nilly putting these
absolutely.
Injection
points so that's,
things out?
This idea took about like a week to flesh out, right? And the rest of the 4 years was to solve that problem.
Okay.
And you know, people always ask, so you're just injecting random places and putting your own functionality in. How do you do it without breaking the device? And you know, like the answer is carefully, right? Because there are all sorts of things you can do to understand where you are in the code, right? How much CPU resource you really can take by looking at the performance counters, by looking at the code structure around it. It's all heuristic. You know,
so that's device ends up being device specific or class of device
it,
specific?
It ends up being more or less ISA specific, actually. Huh. I mean, we're working with device performance counters, right? That I'll show you, I have a graph where we have a Cisco IOS router where the CPU utilization is completely flat. Right, and we do this by monitoring in tiny little microbursts the current CPU utilization of that device, right? And anything under the flat curve that's not used by the system is then used by security, by the symbiote. And then we figured out ways of basically jumping out of, you know, very tight spin loops, right, without understanding that we're inside spin loops by doing this type of trick. So that took some time, but that works.
Cool. All right, thanks.
I actually remember there was a paper long some time ago by Moshe Jung and your author on remote software attestation by software injection. So you may want.
Yeah, so that's the ArcSan paper, right, on software guards.
I don't remember the name of the paper, but they have this patent. So,
We looked at the Arc. Yeah, we looked at the software guard paper. The thing that's different here is the guards are essentially inline monitors, whereas we are something that's much more different. Like, we are basically a OS agnostic binary scheduler that's injected into the host program. We carry state. We carry state for an entire, essentially we can put a new operating system inside the operating system that we inject into. Instead of, you know, checking code integrity from one function call to the next and not holding any state past that.
Because I remember the patent was quite close.
As they are, yeah.
Other comments, questions? All right, thanks again for a really...